Audiobooks have been part of my working life for probably about 3 or 4 years now. I started when I was doing a series of Robin Hood, and I was asked to do 4 of those audiobooks, and they were my first experience of doing them. It was interesting because I knew the characters so well in that show, and they were books which were taken from scripts. It was less of a challenge than something like Venetia, whereby that's a brand new novel to me, but I really liked the potential to do as many different characters as possible and find some real storytelling quality in my voice, which is a big challenge. In terms of approach, I'd only ever really listened to audiobooks. I remember listening to Lord of the Rings quite a lot as a child, and also listening to radio plays, which I think I listen to usually when I'm travelling. So I sort of realised how useful they are and how important they are and how much pleasure people get from them. So I really thought that my contribution might be valid. I think the enjoyment of reading an audiobook comes from the challenge of creating a world and creating lots of different characters and sort of researching where those voices might come from, because although you can go quite easily to stereotypes, it's always better to find voices that you've heard somewhere. So I suppose I listen to a lot of radio, and more recently something which has occurred is when you listen to a radio phone-in and you get members of the public that call in, it's really useful to sort of listen, because you don't have the visual contact, you're just using your ear to hear somebody's voice. Often you can kind of create a little archive for yourself of different voices. There was a lady on the radio the other day which sort of eventually became Lady Denny in Venetia. She was quite an old lady, sounded quite breathless, so things like that are quite useful. I haven't listened to an audiobook for some time. As I say, it was mainly radio plays. With the ability to download onto an iPod, which I use a lot, I think it would be something I'd certainly consider on a much longer journey, although I do quite like to read for myself and create the characters for myself. I think also, you know, when you can't get your eyes down to a book, it's quite good to have it, for example, driving or somewhere where your hands aren't able to hold a book. I do enjoy Georgette Heyer. I think she's a really comic writer. I'd like to strangle her, actually, for writing these incredibly long sentence constructions. But actually, that's part of the fun of it, because we speak in such short sound bites these days, and everything is so short and immediate that when you're faced with a sentence which is really a paragraph long, and you have to drive the thought through and keep the idea and the syntax all in the right place, I find that frustrating but really challenging. And when you get it right and you hit it, it's very satisfying. I think that finding the comedy in Georgette Heyer is it's there on the page, and everyone will have their own reaction to it. Part of bringing my own sense of humour, what makes me laugh, to the table when I'm reading an audiobook is frustrating, because I find things in that book funny and some people wouldn't. But I think you just have to really enjoy reading the book, and I think that enjoyment comes through by the demonstration of the comedy. I'm usually reading a book which is connected to a job that I'm involved in, so really my own personal taste has seemed to have been put on the side burner for a moment, really. I suppose I've been reading a lot of spy novels, John le Carré and Frederick Forsyth, and then quite a lot of military reference books for the last job that I did. I do enjoy fantasy, so I was always into Tolkien and some sci-fi. I like J.G. Ballard. John Fowles is a favourite author of mine, so hopefully I'll be able to go and pick up something of my own taste rather than a reference piece of research. I've been doing recently a piece based on a novel by Chris Ryan called Strike Back, hence the military research. There's a possibility that that may continue for more series than this. That has sort of connected me into a certain area of literature, which I wouldn't necessarily have chosen. I'm also hoping to create a piece of drama based on the life of Richard III. There's an awful lot of biography written about him, but very little fact. So that's opening up a whole avenue of research for me as well. It's a project which has been around for a few years, but it's certainly picking up some interest now. I also have a personal connection to the author and the scriptwriter, and hopefully be able to get it off the ground. Thank you. Venetia by Georgette Heyer, read by Richard Armitage. One.
A fox got in amongst the hens last night and ravished our best layer, remarked Miss Lanyon. Her great-grandmother, too. You'd think he would be ashamed.
Receiving no answer, she continued in an altered voice.
Indeed you would. It's a great deal too bad. What is to be done?
His attention caught, her companion raised his eyes from the book which lay open beside him on the table and directed them upon her in a look of aloof inquiry.
What's that? Did you say something to me, Venetia?
Yes, love, responded his sister cheerfully. But it wasn't of the least consequence, and in any event, I answered for you.
I was reading.
So you were, and have let your coffee grow cold, besides abandoning that slice of bread and butter. What is it? Some improving tale, I don't doubt.
The Medea, he said repressively.
I know. She was the delightful creature who cut up her brother and cast the pieces in her papa's way, wasn't she?
I dare say perfectly amiable when one came to know her.
He hunched an impatient shoulder and replied contemptuously,
You don't understand.
Her eyes twinkled at him. But I promise you I do. Yes, and sympathize with her. Though I think I should rather have buried your remains tidily in the garden, my dear.
Inured to her brother's habits, she made no further attempt to engage his attention. The slice of bread and butter lay half-eaten on his plate, but to expostulate would be a waste of time, and to venture on an inquiry about the state of his health would serve only to set up his hackles. Aubrey Lanyon was a thin boy, rather undersized, by no means ill-looking, but with a countenance sharpened and lined beyond his years. A stranger would have found these hard to compute, his body's immaturity being oddly belied by his face and his manners. In point of fact, he had not long entered on his 17th year, but physical suffering had dug the lines in his face, and association with none but his seniors, coupled with an intellect at once scholarly and powerful, had made him precocious. A disease of the hip joint had kept him away from Eton, where his brother Conway, his senior by 6 years, had been educated, and had resulted in a shortening of one leg. When he walked, it was with a pronounced and ugly limp, and although the disease was said to have been arrested, the joint still pained him. A boyhood of enforced physical inertia had strengthened a natural turn for scholarship. The incumbent of the parish was a notable scholar, and had offered to prepare the boy for Cambridge, and Aubrey, thereafter, spent the better part of his days at the parsonage, poring over texts in the Reverend Julius Apperset's dim bookroom. He was entered already at Trinity College, where he would be admitted at Michaelmas in the following year, and Mr. Apperset had little doubt that, young though he would still be, he would very soon be elected a scholar. Venetia was 9 years his senior, the eldest of the three surviving children of a Yorkshire landowner of long lineage, comfortable fortune, and eccentric habits. The loss of his wife before Aubrey was out of short coats had caused Sir Francis to immure himself in the vastness of his manor, Undershaw, some 15 miles from York, and to remain there sublimely indifferent to the welfare of his offspring, abjuring the society of his fellows. His children grew up in the desert of his creating. Only Conway, sent to Eton and passing thence into the Nth Foot, escaping into a larger world. Neither Venetia nor Aubrey had been farther from Undershaw than Scarborough, and their acquaintance was limited to the few families living within reach of the manor. Neither repined. Aubrey because he shrank from going amongst strangers, Venetia because it was not in her nature to do so. She had only once been disconsolate. That was when she was 17, and Sir Francis had refused to let her go to his sister in London to be presented and brought out into society. It had seemed hard, and some tears had been shed. However, though Papa would not consent to a London season, he raised no objection to her attending the assemblies in York, or even in Harrogate, whenever Lady Denny or Mrs. Yardley invited her to go with them, which they quite frequently did.
Nor was Papa at all mean. He never questioned her household expenditure, bestowed a handsome allowance on her, and somewhat to her surprise, left her, at his death, a very respectable competence. This event had occurred 3 years previously, within a month of the glorious victory at Waterloo, and quite unexpectedly, of a fatal stroke. It had been a shock to his children, but not a grief. "In fact," said Venetia, scandalizing kind Lady Denny, "we go on very much better without him."
"My dear,"
gasped her ladyship, who had come to the manor prepared to clasp the orphans to her sentimental bosom,
"you are overwrought."
"Indeed I'm not," Venetia replied, laughing. "Why, ma'am, how many times have you declared him to have been the most unnatural parent?" Finding this unanswerable, Lady Denny merely begged her not to say such things, and made haste to ask what she now meant to do. Venetia had said that it all depended on Conway. Until he came home to take up his inheritance, there was nothing she could do but continue in the old way.